Welcome to Habitual Excellence, presented by Value Capture. This podcast in our firm is all about helping you and your organization achieve habitual excellence via one unifying focus, one value-based structure, and one performance system. In other words, it's about helping you capture dramatically more value through achieving perfect care and perfect safety for patients and staff. To learn more about Value Capture and our services, visit www.valuecapturellc.com. Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to Habitual Excellence. I'm Mark Raven, and we're joined today. Our guest is Ron Suskind. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and investigative reporter. Ron, through his career, has been previously a contributor to the New York Times Magazine and to Esquire. He was the Wall Street Journal's senior national affairs reporter from 1993 until 2000. And he's the best-selling author of 6 books on topics ranging from terrorism to autism. In his 2004 book titled The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, the White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill is why we're talking today. So first off, Ron, thank you for joining us here today. How are you?
Great. Good to be with you, Mark. You and your gang. This will be fun.
Yeah. So, you know, if people were wondering at the beginning why you were here, the end of the subtitle of your book, I think, made that very clear. And you mentioned, you know, facts and truth and data. In that interview with Terry Gross, you said Paul was the king of facts. And in that interview, I mean, you know, if she was asking questions, sort of asking him to speculate, he wouldn't do it. I mean, I remember, you know, a couple points in that interview where his answer was basically, I don't know, you'd have to ask so-and-so. But, you know, so this phrase, you know, the king of facts, and I was wondering if you could just sort of elaborate a little bit on that label of him.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons that I've said since the book came out in January 20, 2004, yeah, and I had a great run, you know, whatever, month and a half at the top of the Times bestseller list, drove events, really framed the Bush administration and the Bush-Cheney administration, set the table for many events and understandings that would follow, frankly, even to this day. Paul was just a dream subject for a book, because the man is just a champion of rigor, of fact-based. What do the facts show? Is there evidence here? Is there evidence upon which we can rely independently that everyone says, yes, that is indisputable. I see it. You see it. It's a vase. It's a pot. It's a wheel of a car. It can be agreed upon that this is evidence that is not in dispute. This is what we know. Here's how we know it. Here's what the data shows. You know, here is a thing that lives outside of the competing opinions of men and women. Paul lives for that. He just lives for it. And so I could spend this year and this time with a person whose divining rod as to evidence, I mean, just so beautifully precise in discovery. You know, how do we know that? We don't. Here's how we know it. Well, it's because of this. That's what reporters do too. And Paul, of course, that's what Paul O'Neill did. I mean, people would come in with all sorts of notions of this or that, or posits, sort of notions. Well, I was like, okay, well, what is it we can rely on that we can know? All right. What is it that can be proven? What is it that will live in an independent place of a kind of soundness empirically that will help guide us? Then we can all rely on that shared place, because that's, I think, what evidence and what facts do. They give you a place to gather. Okay, that we know. Okay, this we wonder about. It may be where we're going. It may be the outcome that is yet uncertain. But having a foundation of fact is the O'Neill had was the O'Neill way.
I mean, that was the O'Neill way when he was CEO of Alcoa. And imagine, you know, it must have been a challenging transition to go from being the CEO of a corporation to being a cabinet member, even though you say, you know, you make it sound like he had a lot of autonomy over Treasury, but now he's part of a team, part of George W. Bush's cabinet. And this rigor towards facts and knowledge probably came up both in economic matters and other discussions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's interesting is that, you see, well, one of the things was fascinating about Paul's experience and his, and again, his widely publicly known experiences is that Paul actually, when he was working in the Bureau of the Budget under Lyndon Johnson, the newly formed OMB under Richard Nixon, and then deputy head of OMB, he and Frank Zarb, and, you know, they ran the government on when Nixon was, you know, in Watergate hell. I mean, you know, Paul comes from a time when the respect for the known and knowable was central. I mean, there was never, you know, that's the way government was working in that earlier period, you know. Then he arrives kind of decades later into a time where message and impression and, you know, projection, where the reality-based communities had been profoundly diminished, and he was again like a man from a past that had vanished, saying, "Well, you can't make this decision based on what I know you know. Let's find out what is knowable. Let's discover what we do now rely upon as the facts of the case." Many of those things, along with the policy process, had been largely subordinated to message, the political mandate, and to the idea that that we, in our statements from atop the great empire of America, we can create a reality with the things we say. And that reality will shape behavior and action and in a way create all sorts of new sets of facts for you fact people. And that O'Neill thought was an irresponsible way to conduct something as important as the affairs of the world's greatest power. And that put him in conflict with many people in the administration. He was ever the skunk at the garden party. I mean, Colin Powell was in his way too. They talked about that, foreign and domestic, you know, because Secretary of State and Treasury, they're the two senior roles.
Right.
But they talked about being at one point when Powell was about to go in front of the United Nations, he talked to Paul. Paul's already out of the administration at that point. They had known each other. Powell was actually worked as an intern at OMB under Nixon. They'd known each other for years.
Oh, wow.
Brother Paul. And they talked about their roles of being, you know, the skunk at these garden parties. Mm-hmm. And Paul gave it a nice analogy. It's almost like, Colin, you and I are like in these long boats. And we're the ones jamming the oars. And that's the way both of them are in their various roles, foreign and domestic. Well, Paul says something interesting to Powell. He says, you know, but here's the thing, you know, as the boat moves downstream, if you remain in the boat, you are of the boat. You know, even if you offer that, you know, opposing position and that contrary view, and make sure they hear that. You know, the only way to preserve your integrity is to get out of the boat. Mm-hmm. And Powell, years hence, would say Paul really was wise to try to warn me of what was ahead. if I did not leap from the boat prior to me sitting in front of the United Nations. You know, where Powell said that where my I ruined a big part of what I had built in my life. But he gets right to the principles of O'Neill, you know, speak the truth as best as you can know it and render it and express it.
Yeah.
Don't fear it. It's all we have.
Well, and all of that makes me think of healthcare. And after leaving Treasury, you know, Mr. O'Neill was involved in a number of groups around Pittsburgh, and with Paul O'Neill Jr. And others. You know, he was the first non-executive chairman of our firm, Value Capture, and hearing him speak many times to healthcare audiences, Mr. O'Neill would speak uncomfortable truths about facts, data, about harm to patients, harm to healthcare providers. There are times where speaking those truths within healthcare circles could also make you a skunk at the garden party, as you put it. I mean, I'm curious, how much did you talk to Mr. O'Neill over the years or decades about healthcare and his observations and goals? And
endlessly.
Tell us about
endlessly.
That.
Obviously, running the regional healthcare initiative in Pittsburgh and the Allegheny area, and all the speeches he's giving, you know, he would often talk to me, he'd call me up, you know, when he's about to give a speech, and we would riff, we'd riff some lines. Paul was ferocious. He's like, no. No covering your tuchus here. You know, we can be better. We can do better. You know, we all can be better. You know, right now we have a system in which a lot of people are not doing a lot of things that actually can make patient care and the well-being of patients, so much improved. Look, humans are prone to error. You know, we never want to acknowledge that. You know, especially in the medical establishment. You know, we wear that white coat, the God coat. We carry kind of a writ of infallibility. Inside of that, there are all sorts of things that doctors are not doing that really will change the lives of patients. I mean, the errors, he would see errors once he dug into the data, the amount of errors on people writing prescriptions. That was one of his big things.
Right.
Error, you know, and doctors, I can't read it. Well, it must be that. No, it wasn't that. It was this. Next thing you know, a patient is taking the wrong medication. Who's going to acknowledge that? Ooh, go away.
Yeah.
You know, not washing your hands. Oh, my God. You know, I mean, he just said, I am going to just keep going at the core issue for Paul. Good process creates good outcomes.
Right.
Good process. So, and right now, what I see here, and there is bad process. All right. Process that can be improved. And when it is improved and people stick with the improvements, the things that we know, because by studying the flaws, by studying the places it's broken, repairing them, changing the way we do what we do, everyone will be better off. Wow. I mean, you know, I'm a buddy of Atul Gawande with his checklist. Paul precedes Atul. Okay.
Right.
You know, Paul's doing that, basically. And doing it in terms of let's change the process of what we do and how we do it. And the key is to look hard at ourselves and the mistakes that we make, the oversights, the blind spots, the things we do out of habit that ends up actually showing enormous deleterious outcome. I mean, you know, when you look at what he did when he got to Treasury, he did what he did at Alcoa, you know, looking at how people get hurt doing what they do. That was his big Alcoa aha,
right?
You know, where he says, I don't want anyone to get hurt making this product aluminum. And people looked at him and said, are you mad?
Mm-hmm.
It's aluminum. It's giant vats of aluminum and cranes. And the normative level of workplace injuries, we're good. We're below it. We're, you know, we're doing fine. He's like, no, we should just, no one should get hurt doing the thing we do here. And my God, look at the changes that came from that. I mean, it's just one of the most beautiful stories in the American firmament. I mean, Paul just going crazy as soon as he gets to Alcoa on that score. And someone gets killed in Australia because the crane hits them. Paul flies down there and says, well, why is the crane that way? Why is it swing that way? Let's fix that. Well, that's going to be a lot of money because it's in all of our factories in 140 countries. That's what happened. Well, we're going to fix that.
Yeah.
Because someone got killed because of the way the crane does that. It won't do that anymore. We'll make a new crane. What does this do? It not only saves lives, maybe, and obviously keeps people from being hurt. It allowed the people who work in Alcoa to say, this guy cares about me and my fortunes, about my life. I'm not just some widget here. And he's looking at, well, you know, a lot of people get hurt doing this and whatever. That's the way it goes. He's caring about me. And all of a sudden, that alone, that change creates an enormous burst of productivity at Alcoa, where people at the bottom on the factory floors are saying, are feeling different about themselves. And they're starting to act in a different way. And they're saying, you know, I'm valuable. And, you know, they do something stupid here. Why do we do it that way? This is a better way to do it. And that all of a sudden is making for 5 steps as opposed to 20 steps. And productivity starts to explode inside of Alcoa, and suddenly the making of aluminum starts to be profitable. After all the years where everyone in aluminum and other similar industries, like, there's no way you can make money the way they hope you make money on Wall Street or demand making aluminum. So we're going to diversify and go into shopping malls and whatever, whatever. And that was Paul, because he says it matters. It matters that you do it in a way that is best, that we care about people. And it got to that key moment, the key moment in the Great O'Neill saga, where all of those, the remaining executives at Alcoa, after most had been fired, after Paul had been there a short time, and being a zealot about no one's going to get hurt making aluminum, they came in one after another and said, Paul, we think you're doing this because you want to lower workplace injuries so we can save money and there's more money in the bonus pool for. He's like, no, you're fired. Okay, bye. So finally, the last group came in, the stragglers, and most of them, as they reported to me, had come to fall, the remaining, the survivors, because their wives had taken them aside after obviously colleagues had been ousted. And they're like, just go, Charlie, and just ask him, just say, just please help me understand what do you want? What am I doing that I could change? And they came in, the last group who didn't want to relocate. And they said, so we think, we think you're doing this because we want to show the people who actually work here, the zillions of them, we want to show them that we care about them. Is that it? We want to show them.
If they're finally getting it, right?
Yeah. And that was one of the great moments where O'Neill's like, you know, look, you guys have come this far. I'll take you the last step, the key last step, you know, and it's this. If you want to show them you care, you actually have to care. And that's the O'Neill story. So what are those principles there? I mean, those are the, these are the core O'Neill principles. You've got to be authentic. You actually have to care about them, because that will make all the difference. And that's a beautiful point of O'Neillian clarity.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many folks who so deeply admired Paul in the world of healthcare. I knew many of them, all the leaders in healthcare in America. They're like, yeah, O'Neill, he's a Copernican character, one of them called me. He helps us see, mm-hmm. helps us think more deeply about the human engagement, about the fact that we are here to help people live lives of health and wholeness, and as long as possible. Now, we are a business, we know that, but we need to be guided by principles that are other than those that shape short-term returns.
And so Paul thankfully did influence many executives in healthcare. I've interviewed a good number of those CEOs, you know, here in this podcast series, who talked about that direct influence and mentoring from Paul O'Neill. I got a message the other day from somebody at a group in Michigan, a group called the Michigan Lean Consortium, which includes a number of people from healthcare organizations. And somebody on the board of this group had just read the book that we had published with some of the transcripts of some of Paul's speeches for healthcare audiences. And this guy said, and I'm going to pose this question to you, Ron, it's maybe not easy to answer, but I'll throw it at you anyway. So this guy, Joe, is saying that he thought Paul O'Neill cracked the code with safety. What I can't understand is why the rest of us haven't followed that path of full reporting, accountability, and working to take, to not focus on just the bottom line arguments. What could we do to help influence others? Is there a path to that?
One of the difficulties we face is that we're living within a set of structures and processes that Paul talked a lot about, and he and I talked a lot about, that that rewards a certain cluster or a group of incentives, serves to diminish others. I mean, you know, Paul used to talk about big giant sectors of the world and the economy in which process is broken. When I look at so many of these issues, I say if we were able to alter the incentives, and that's a big part of what government does. It's a big part of what I think all manner of human progress does in shaping the ways in which we kind of act and move and live our lives. The rules that govern that, you end up having essentially a different way in which the world works. Right now, we have short-term incentives and very little longitudinal accountability in many areas of our life, in both the public and private sectors. Paul and I talked a lot about that. He was a big believer in stretching out those systems of accountability, having real consequences connected to them. And when I look at the focus on the bottom line, you see many folks who essentially say, you know, that's what wins the day. We're under pressure to meet the measure of that yardstick. And we respond to that pressure. When I think of how the world could look different, and this is something we talked about, is just to say, look, what we're going to think about here is we're going to think about how you and your institution manages itself over 5 years. Okay, So we're not going to have the return on investment, occur by the hour or day. And you being part of that as a manager of the large entity to get your rewards, we're going to stretch it out so that the actions have consequences, as do the improvements in terms of the core issues of care, for instance. Mm-hmm. As to people really knowing that here is why things didn't work out. You should know that. Mm-hmm. That's not something that should be hidden. This is why we are not able to meet our charge or meet our mandate in caring for you. Here is what we'll do about that.
Yeah.
Here's how we get better. Here's how we are better than we were, because we have continuous improvement based on a rigor and embrace of the truest things that we can discover. Do you trust us more now than you did when we didn't act this way? Yes, I think that would be a yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And we talk about the loss of trust in institutions of all kinds. You know, public and private. Mm-hmm. What surprises anyone about that? I mean, really?
Yeah.
You know, we're living in a Gutenberg moment. Again, another, this is all, it's like Paul and I talking to each other. This is what we talked about. You know, we're in it. I mean, and it's a time of habit by virtue of that. You know, an enormous democratization of information. And of knowledge. It's there at the touch of a fingers to anyone with a device. All human knowledge there for you. All right? Well, that's creating a lot of havoc in terms of the way power is arrayed, how it's expressed, top and bottom, people having strength from knowledge that they didn't have, people knowing what's knowable at all levels. I mean, my God, you know, it's very Gutenberg-like. Before Gutenberg, you know, who had the truth? The priests, the nobles, right. Whatever. They told everyone this is what's true and they're done. Then all of a sudden, people are reading for themselves. And it caused 150 years of religious wars. But nonetheless, you know, we're in a moment like that now. Mm-hmm. And Paul, in a way, is a person who lived as best he could, that future that had not yet arrived and was arriving toward the end of his life.
Yeah.
He was a guy saying, what is knowable? Let's talk about that. Let's have that be our starting point. And how can we learn more? Okay. And then those are the truths you can own together in the large concert of people carrying forward shared principles. Mm-hmm. You know, is it okay that these people die in a preventable fashion? No. Is it all right that terrible diseases are born inside of institutions, medical institutions? Because people are not washing their hands? Mm-hmm. What, are you kidding me? They're busy. I know they're busy, the doctors, the nurses. But we're going to make it so that they have no way to not do this very basic thing that saves the lives of the people they're treating. Okay, can we work on that? Well, that, how about that? And, you know, when Paul would rail against the legalism and the legal structures that often push us in all of the wrong directions. No, if we acknowledge that, oh boy. Just think of the civil suits. Just think about, he's like, well, that's going to be the cost of doing the right thing. Just put that in your model and assume that that's something that, you know, you'll have to pay. to be better.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just think of, you know, all of these, this is all wisdom. And it gets to value. I mean, you know, I see this in Paul Jr. I see it in lots of folks who are of this ethic, who embrace this ethic of a kind of rigor and a kind of clarity about how we can be our best, how we can ever improve, how we can say that I'm in the act of being the very best I can be to carry forward the principles that are central to the life of worth. That's our boy. That's our God.
So when you talk about principles living on, maybe a final question for you, Ron, you know, during the memorial service for Paul last year, you talked about how, you know, his mark would endure, that there was a legacy there. Can you tell us, you know, why you think that is, and what principles or qualities will carry forward?
I think what the principles that that guided and illuminated Paul's life, and that he got to employ in both the public and private sectors, which I think is important, that it's not just in his role in government, but also in his role in business, and how similar his actions and activities were really in both sectors. I think there's certain ideals abide. One is courage. He was a courageous guy. He said, "Look, I know what's right, and it's not really in dispute. It's not conditional. It's not matters of situational ethics or assessment. There's certain things that are shown to be the right things to do."
Yeah.
Be truthful. Be humble. Say, "I don't know. I'm not going to fake it." Be honest with the people around you, who work for you, who work with you. Tell them things that show that you have no corner on all of the right things all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, humble. He had a kind of humility and tucked into that. I think what he did is he altered significantly the way people conducted themselves in American business. They still study O'Neill's actions and examples at business schools around the country. Yeah. And it is, he is cited as one of the key actors in the management of the government of the United States. I mean, truly, you know, there've been a lot of treasury secretaries. There've been a lot of senior officials of government, even presidents. But O'Neill's example for what he did during his time in government early on, and then in his key final role as Treasury Secretary, it's a signature moment of a nation ruled by laws and not men, of the way government works furiously and with a deep sense of professionalism, to do the best it can do, is to know everything it can know, is to act with prudence and with all of the wisdom it can acquire. Mm-hmm. Just think about it. He's standing up to a sitting president during their actionable time, which is the Brent Scowcroft's line, during their term. And essentially, he is saying he's a whistleblower. You know? As Treasury Secretary, he's sitting there saying, "I am not going to let this proceed without me stating clearly here is what it is.
That was his way, going back to your analogy, I guess, of getting off the boat.
Yep. Well, he said it inside the building many, many times. And he saw they ignored him or steamrolled right over him.
Yeah.
I don't think he went out there to say, I'm going to say this publicly, and that will be some sort of, you know, particularly corrective. He felt that he should, that it was sound to trust truth. He was living in a place that was throwing out falsehoods often by the hour. And he's like, no, that gets you into trouble. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do what I know to do, which is to allow and embrace the idea of me being at the center of a big piece of nonfiction where my voice will be heard, where all the evidence will be freely examined. Again, not me, but Susskind and others who he interviews, because I had hundreds of sources in that book. Paul was the central source, but everyone joined. And we will have a record of this time. And it will come out within a time in which this knowledge can actually shape action. You know, in a way, he was looking at what he felt was the sound policy process and saying, I will be party to making that kind of a process happen across America because I trust the American people. Look, Paul grew up with poor people. Mm-hmm. He knew poor people. He knew people from one edge of America to the other. He was not a believer in the fact that someone who has lots of education and fancy graduate degrees is innately more sensible or more wise or more intelligent in terms of the essential things than a person who is unlettered and not fortunate enough to be born on second base.
Yeah.
And that's because he had lived it. He had lived, it is so rare to have someone go from one edge of America to the other in one lifetime. Yeah. Very rare. And that's why he says, I'm going to be party to a process in which the American people can know all that is knowable about this moment in which we're living. They deserve that. They're the sovereign here. Mm-hmm. I and others where I'm living, we are public servants, public people with enormous power, hands on the levers, driving historic events and driving outcomes and the fortunes of many people in this country and abroad. But we are servants. The master are the people. They are the sovereign. They deserve to know everything they can know so they can be most informed, most aware, most apt, ready, and empowered to know the best things to do on behalf of themselves and the nation in which they live. Mm-hmm. It's a lovely idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's fundamental to what makes America a unique player in the long history of human beings.
Mm-hmm. And you described Paul O'Neill earlier as, you know, a man of another time. I'd like to think those principles are not behind us and that those principles are still part of creating a better future.
You know, they surely and indisputably are, Mark. Power will exercise its prerogatives to either disagree or discard some of those stated venerable principles that we know time and again are the ones that save our tuchus. All right? That's what power does.
Yeah.
And the struggle is ever the betterment of man against all sorts of forces, and often against our own selves and what we do for all sorts of reasons to get what we want. And the whole, we're living in times now that there's times where I'm saying, I actually feel glad that Paul is not here when I see some of the things happening each and every day. I can just hear him on the phone at 6 a.m. Did you see it? Did you read what happened today? You know, and then he would pause and he would speak a principle. That's what he did. He paused and he would speak a principle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, look, you know, here's the thing, is that we find a way. Human beings find a way. The history of that is strong. At some point, we say, I get it, and this is how we bend toward the sunlight in as great a unison multitude as is manageable and possible. Mm-hmm. You know, we do it. We're good at it. You know, and we will.
Mm-hmm.
We do now in certain ways. Sometimes we bend against, but often we bend with. You know, there's zigs and zags. Often it's, you know, two steps forward and one back, and even one step forward, two back on the key issues of progress, of human progress. But generally, we move forward. And so I'm utterly confident it will remain thus. And I think Paul was a very optimistic man in that very mm-hmm. same way, which is really what he did every day. He got up there to try to create the thing better. And boy, he worked hard doing it. God, man alive, up at 5:30, working into the night, a believer in our ability to make the world a better place. Each of us in our own and in countless ways. I think it's a good summation of our guy here on his birthday.
Yeah.
We are very happy he was born and cut a wide wake across mm-hmm. his 80 plus years for the greater good, which is what he did.
Well, Ron, thank you for sharing, you know, your recollections and reflections of somebody who you got to know very well and made a mark on you. So really appreciate you, you know, sharing wide-ranging thoughts, and it's yeah, very helpful, very inspiring to hear, you know, the story of optimism that comes through, the inspiration for those of us who try to carry on parts of his message or to carry on his to carry the torch in ways that are constructive. That's helpful fuel to keep going. So I want to appreciate you. Thank you for sharing all that. Again, you know, our guest today here has been Ron Suskind, a journalist, investigative reporter, author of the book, with Paul O'Neill being the main source and subject, The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, the White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill. Ron, thank you for helping us with, I think, education as listeners, myself included. So thank you.
Great joy to be with you, Mark.
Thank you.
Be well. Happy birthday.
Thanks for listening to Habitual Excellence, presented by Value Capture. We hope you'll subscribe to the podcast, and please also rate and review it in your favorite podcast directory or app. To learn more about Value Capture and how we can help your organization on this journey to habitual excellence, visit our website at www.valuecapturellc.com.